Well, I'm sorry for the delay, but
no problem. It'll
come out the same way at the end.
Yes.
In any event.
The same.
It's good to have you here. I've read The Women of Whitechapel and Jack the Ripper with tremendous interest. It's really a fascinating story. But before we go on to talk about the book, let's talk a little bit about you and how you came to be a writer, where you're from, and your family, and all of that.
All of that. You can probably tell from the bastardized way I speak that I was born in England.
I kind of thought
so. Can you tell that, or do you think it's some sort of slewed Canadian or whatever? Over this medium, it shows up a great deal. So I've been here 30 years, I think, something like that.
You've been where 30 years?
Well, in the United States.
Oh, you live in the United States?
Oh, sure.
Currently?
Yeah, I've been here all of that time.
Oh, now where do you live in the U.S.?
In Ithaca, New York, in the Finger Lakes.
Are you teaching at Cornell?
Sometimes, yeah. Usually not. Mm-hmm. Usually I sit there and write 4 or 5 hours a day. I mean literally day, starting at midnight until 4:30 in the morning. It sounds peculiar to people who don't do it, but it works. All the vibrations stop at that time.
So you are a person who works at night, late at night.
I call it night. Other people call it day. I see the dawn before anybody else.
Yeah. No, that's not unusual. That's the same way with me. For some reason,
You're a night person.
I'm an amateur writer myself, and I... of course, I have a day job, but I find that even when I'm not working at my day job, when I start to write, for some reason, I don't start until 9 or 10. I don't know why it is, but there's something about the crickets and the lightning bugs outside that seem to be helpful.
Well, I switch on the all-night classical music, when I can get it anyway, and start about midnight. And if I write 4 hours, I consider I've had a good day. But if I don't do 4 hours, I don't worry about it. There's always another day.
Ah, but something better than the all-night classical music. You can get a tape deck that has an automatic reverse.
I've been told about this.
Two tape decks, you know, so it plays one side of the tape and then switches over to the other side, so it's got two decks, and you can go for hours and hours and not have to change it, or listen to the commercials and the newscast.
Yeah, the longest novel I ever wrote, which is The Place in Flowers Where Pollen Rests, was written to the same cassette. I think I heard the thing 1,200 times. Just played it and played it and played it, and it somehow neutralized everything else and put me on a creative shelf. I haven't heard the music since. It was Bozzoni piano music, and I think that if anybody played it now, I would run screaming away. But at that time, it was catalytic, you know. It was really important to have this music playing while doing the writing. And it had nothing to do with the subject at all.
But if you live, because you live in a nice, quiet locale, but if you lived in Manhattan the way I do, you hear all of the street noise. Bottles being broken on the sidewalk, horns,
I don't know,
automobile alarms,
if you get
fire engines.
The air shaft and close the windows and put the air conditioning on high, maybe you can achieve some kind of anechoic silence.
Well, there's another recourse, too. They're called environmental tapes. So you buy these cassette tapes, and it's the sound of bubbling water, you know, creeks flowing, crickets, and wind. See the surf hitting the beaches.
Aren't they good to go to sleep, too? I mean, don't they provoke the subdominant hemisphere of the brain?
They're great for sex.
Great for, well, that's what I said. off, yeah. I didn't mean that, but you followed it very well.
So you've been in the United States for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what brought you to our native shores?
Well, I went to Canada first and found Canada pleasant enough, and then had a Guggenheim and came to the States and went to Penn State, where they said, we need somebody to teach Shakespeare. And I said, well, I don't know anything about Shakespeare. And they said, well, you know, that qualifies you. So here you go. And so I taught Shakespeare for 3 years.
Well, Shakespeare is
easy. Then they let me loose onto other things.
Shakespeare is easy. You only wrote one book, you know.
That's right. Titus Andronicus.
No, it's the collected works of Shakespeare.
You can't tell students that. You give them the collected Shakespeare, and they say, which page do you want us to memorize?
Where in England were you born?
Derbyshire, which is the northeast Midlands, not the pretty part. The pretty part is farther south, but it's pretty enough. It's rural.
Yeah.
Rural and mining. So what you see on top is lovely, but what is down below is nothing. It's hollowed out. They've taken all the coal out, and that's that. There's no more coal to get. So I guess that area now is a sort of tourist draw. There aren't any mines working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But when I grew up, it was mining, all of it. And you'd see miners going through the village streets in their wooden clogs. It was like a scene from Holland or something.
What kind of family did you have? A mining family? A literary family? Or what?
not literary. Engineering and musical.
Uh-huh.
Nicely split. My ambition was to be an aeronautical engineer and design jets and stuff like that. But I don't think my math was quite up to that. But my languages were, so I got pushed into what they used to then call arts, in the arts side of the school.
And what did you?
I was grateful.
What did you go to school?
A small grammar school in Derbyshire.
And for
not
higher?
Not fashionable or powerful.
Your higher education?
Oxford and Columbia.
Ah, well, that's...
Columbia is where I got seeded with the desire to come back to the States, you see. Well, once you've been here, you have to come back.
What did you study at Columbia?
English and French lit, 20th century.
Had you known from a reasonably early age that you wanted to use words, to write?
Yeah, I started writing when I was about 10, and I wrote heroic stories about handsome pilots who got shot down in enemy territory and prevailed and survived. I don't know where those stories went to. I hope they were destroyed.
Oh, well, they're terrific stories, though. They're still being written. Tom Cruise plays the pilot.
Same thing. No
well,
difference.
Tell me, you've written a lot of stuff here.
Yeah,
nonfiction, poetry?
I began as a poet and then moved on to essays and then moved on to novels. Always looking, I guess, for more elbow room, more space, something to navigate through.
Boy, you've got great titles, too. Bela Lugosi's White Christmas, Calaman's Filibuster.
I think some of them are a bit baroque, but never mind. They were okay at the time, and I guess they'll endure. And once you've done it, you've done it.
Well, tell me about your first novel. That's probably the biggest hurdle any writer has, is to get by his first book.
I don't want to talk about my first novel. I've virtually disowned it.
Do you have it listed in your credits?
I don't think so, no. Talk about the second one.
That's going to the second
one. The first
one
is beyond my ken now. I don't like it much.
What's the title?
I'm not going to tell you.
Well, it's either Lord Byron's Daughter or Tenements of Clay.
It's neither of those. Tenements of Clay.
Second book is not listed in your credits?
The second novel I wrote to the sounds of Prokofiev, and I'm quite happy with. It's the Caspar Hauser story, but the first one, it's a rare book, and I've tried to buy up all the copies that are around and hide them away from public view.
Well, that's not unusual. E.L. Doctorow's has hidden away his first book, and a lot of writers do because I guess writers perfect their craft, don't they, after years of work?
They hope to, yeah. I felt this one was a strange mix of Hemingway pastiche and Faulkner pastiche. You know, okay, as pastiche goes, but it wasn't me. It was an imitation. It was too friendly but alien voices. And you know, the sooner I got rid of them, the better. And I did. And by the time I wrote the second novel, all was well, I think. And it was my voice. But when you write a first novel that isn't you, you have to do something about it.
Of course, you may be more demanding on yourself than the reader.
Maybe so.
Which is certainly understandable. But you grow in complexity, and I've noticed that, most writers grow in complexity. They don't want to keep repeating themselves or writing the same story, so they try new things, different things, and more complex things.
More complex.
Yeah.
You get older. You have maybe fewer nerve endings. You think you know more about life. You want to get it all into the big picture. I'm not sure this is the right way to go. I think the older you get, maybe the less and less you should do, the more you should shrink things and tighten them up and make very pungent and profound epitomes. But it's not the way I'm going. I'm getting bigger and bigger and wider and wider. My books are getting longer.
That's strange. I was talking to Brian Moore not too long ago, and he was telling me that his books are getting smaller and smaller.
He's doing the right thing, I'm sure. I guess it's a matter of temperament. If you let your temperament go, and your temperament goes to large books, then you will go to larger and larger. I mean, you know, there's no maximum. You can still shoot for it, but you'll never get there. There's no minimum either. But I think that people assume if you're writing larger and larger books, then, you know, you're losing control. You have less and less control. I don't think that's true. I think that if you revise very, very slowly, as I do, I write fast and write and revise slowly, then I think you retain the control. And I think if you write very, very tight and short things, maybe you think you're controlling more than you are. It's all optical illusion. You need a good friend who will tell you the truth.
Well, I have noticed, with the exception of Brian Moore, of course, that many writers that I've talked to do seem to expand their words. I think Mailer is coming out with a book. I think it's a Random House book, isn't it? Can't, Harlot's Ghost, I think it's called. What's that, 1,100 pages, something like that?
Or longer.
How much?
Or longer.
Or longer.
Well, that's only a four-night read, is it? I mean, depends how fast you read, but a week should take care of that. I mean, think of how many things people do that take much longer than a week, and if it's a good book, it's well worth a week, I think.
Well, I'm not too happy if I can't get through a book in an evening.
Really?
Investing a week on a book is a large investment for someone who reads four or five books a week.
What do you do with War and Peace? I mean, do you try and read that in an evening?
No. It wasn't possible for me to read The Women of Whitechapel in an evening either. It's a complex book, a difficult book in many respects, and my normal tendency is to rush through a book, to read it fast, and then I find that, no, you can't read it fast. I was talking to William Gass, who was saying that there are some books you can't read fast any more than you can rush through Mozart.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I find myself going back and starting over and finally adopting the pace of the writer.
Yeah, was Gass talking about Proust? I mean, if you try and read Proust, his sentences are so long that you have to read them fast to retain any sense of their architectonic. So you end up actually reading Proust at great speed, although it looks as if you should read him very, very slowly over many, many, many years, and it doesn't work like that. If people write short sentences, the tendency is to read them very slowly. But if you're reading Proust, you have to sort of speed up, otherwise you've forgotten how the sentence began, and then you have to go back. Maybe that's the whole idea of it, that you are perpetually adrift in the same pseudo-sentence.
One of the nice things about reading detective stories and murder mysteries is that they give you signals.
Yeah.
Whereas a literary writer makes you work to get the same information. You know, a mystery writer will actually say, give me that gun, he demanded. Yeah. You know, the sort of thing. And describe the heat and the weather in ways that aren't implied. You know what I'm saying? And so that makes for a very fast and easy read.
Did you find signals in The Women of Whitechapel?
There were signals.
Some thriller aspect.
There were signals, but they weren't obvious. You had to work at them. And it's actually, for the subject matter, a very, very funny book. It was.
There are funny moments. There really are.
Yeah. What was the basement in Guy's Hospital? A pudding club?
Pudding club.
And I was going to... I meant to say I had it on my... I was going to say, welcome to the Pudding Club when you came in, and I forgot.
Welcome to the Pudding Club. It's a good name for a nightclub, thank you. I don't know why I called it that. In British English, the Pudding Club means pregnant. Women still say, I believe, she's in the Pudding Club, meaning that she's pregnant.
Well, we hear about brains...
Not in Victorian English.
We hear about brains turned to mush. I guess you could say brains turned to pudding.
Pudding. Slots, sludge, could have been any of these things. But the Pudding Club sounded vaguely convivial, as if it was a building made of plum puddings with the overtones of Christmas festivity, etc.
Oh, it was a fun place to go.
good place to get yourself squelched.
Well, tell me about the origins of The Women of Whitechapel and Jack the Ripper, and indeed your interest in Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I got interested in, I think, The Women of Whitechapel when I heard Alban Berg's opera Lulu, in which Jack the Ripper lays his hands on Lulu, who has really been asking for it, I guess, and there's this terrible scream that goes on and on and on, and I heard the scream in my mind's ear for a long time before doing anything about it. And then a student of mine wrote a piece of fiction in which she too got to a scream and then stopped and got blocked and brought it into me, and I said, well, why don't you simply protract the scream for 10 or 12 pages? And she did, and it was terrific. So I took a hint from myself and went back and tried to reconstruct the screaming of the women of Whitechapel. When I started researching it, I discovered that in the year before the Ripper really got cracking, that was 1887, there were 500 inquests in Whitechapel, mostly on women who had been disemboweled and set on fire and generally spoiled. Very few of these were solved. There was no explanation, but there was tremendous trade in dead women who could be found floating in the Thames, pieces of them jamming the paddle wheels of the steamers going up and down, and people being paid very small sums of money to swim out and retrieve the pieces of bodies floating, you know, for the simple postcard aspect of the whole thing. This was interesting research, but if you had 500 women being slaughtered in Whitechapel every year, then theoretically, you know, four more wouldn't make any difference. And that's what interested me. Queen Victoria is the person who drew attention to those murders, because she, after the first murder of Polly Nichols in 1888, she sent a memorandum to the then Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, and said to him, in effect, you promised nothing like this would ever happen. How do you single out one butchered woman from 500 with such definite clarity? You wouldn't do it unless you knew something about it. When it was all over, she sent him a telegram. It should have been the other way around. She should have sent the telegram first and the memorandum last, but she sent him a telegram saying, you promised that you and your colleagues would do something about this. I found that very convincing, that there was indeed a plot and a cover-up, and Queen Victoria knew about it. So the Jack the Ripper was Queen Victoria. This is the smart way to put it. People are not satisfied. They say, well, how can you prove this? How do you know? But she was behind it. She knew something about it. She had commissioned Dr. Gull, who was really the most powerful physician in England at the time, and the wealthiest, too. She had commissioned him to do something about it. I think that what she wanted him to do was to take these four prostitutes who'd written letters to her, as it were blackmailing her, and simply put them in the Pudding Club. In other words, in the basement of Guy's Hospital, they would be lured in after being kidnapped, and then they would be lobotomized, which is what he'd been doing with all kinds of women for the last 4 or 5 years. But I think of Dr. Gull as a kind of G. Gordon Liddy gone even more haywire to the nth. And so he, instead of just lobotomizing them, actually had them murdered.
Of course, we should point out that the motivation for Queen Victoria's actions in your book, of course, is the relationship between Prince Eddie and one of the women with whom he has a secret marriage, and, of course, and a child, indeed. Of course, this is a tremendous scandal that Victoria just could not abide.
In many ways, it's a scandal. Not because of the line of inheritance and so on, but because it has to do with sex. And she really was having a terrible time with people who did nothing but sex, like the Prince of Wales, her own son, who was the most famous fornicator in England, and it bothered her. And here was her grandson, Prince Eddie, who was going to become the Duke of Clarence, fornicating bisexually in exactly the same way, and generally failing in all important matters. He was at Cambridge. He couldn't read. Imagine, he'd gone to Cambridge to try and learn to read, and they were giving him Let There Be Light, and he was stumbling over simple words. So they...
Is he related to Ted Kennedy, do you think?
Oh, yes, obviously. I mean, it's in the nose, you can see. It's, the nose and the eyes, definitely. But it's rather pathetic, because here is this strange-looking person, terribly lethargic, a sort of sexual machine in hyperdrive, who can't really speak terribly well and certainly can't read. And he goes into the Bohemia, who goes into the Montmartre of London, and meets a servant girl, a girl living on a pittance, serving sweets in a sweet shop, and she can't read either. They're both illiterate. Here is the pauper, and here is the prince, and they both can't read, and they form an instant attachment, and they have a child. And I found that rather operatic. I found the whole thing rather operatic, in fact. And here they go, and of course it's a scandal. And that's the last thing Queen Victoria wants. She's very unpopular. She's had 7 attempts on her life already. There have been terrible demonstrations in Trafalgar Square against her, Republican demonstrations and socialist demonstrations. She's a German. She's unwanted. They hate her because of the Irish question. So she's watching her step, and she feels very uncomfortable. And here comes this grandson making waves of the most appalling kind. And so it's not surprising that she wanted to cover up anyway. And the cover-up would have worked, I'm quite sure. But if you cover up by disemboweling women and then announcing that you're Jack the Ripper, then it's not much of a cover-up.
Now,
it's an uncovering.
In real life, this is fiction, of course. Or is this your real theory?
This is my and other people's real theory. A good deal of that is fiction. As I think I say in the preface to The Women of Whitechapel, I have based this on facts, but on not many of them. And ultimately, this was probably the right thing to do, because the basis for this whole story is a confession made by Walter Sickert's son, that Sickert, his father, had boasted that he was one of the team that was Jack the Ripper. Of course, 2 years later, Sickert's son denied the whole thing and said that he was just fibbing to make money out of the newspapers and the BBC. But in that case, it's a novel, it's a fiction predicated upon a fib, predicated upon a guess. So the whole thing is nebulous. This will never be solved, and I think that ripperologists, I'm not one of them, tend to bark at one another's heels the whole time. They don't really know. So it's a feat of enormous imagination to try and solve it. It's a challenge.
Yeah. The Queen Victoria theory aside, why do you suppose there is so much interest in Jack the Ripper? Why has he gripped our imagination? There certainly have been more violent, worse crimes following Jack the Ripper and before.
I'm not sure I can answer that. I think it's because it's so blank, and that people deep down really relish an invitation to imagine. They may not admit it. They don't want to be novelists. But I think they love to speculate. I've always thought that fiction is an art of speculation. It's guessing what's going on in people's minds and what their motives are. I think if you put a reader or a consumer in that position, he or she will respond very well. People like a mystery, and this is pure mystery, and there's very little that is known about it. And if you read the books, many, many books, hundreds of them, by ripperologists, you find there's not really much fact. There's a tremendous amount of erudite speculation, but the real facts have gone. I mean, if there were any facts lying around, they've probably been bombed in the Blitz in World War II. A lot of stuff at Scotland Yard was destroyed. So if it had been held back, we would never know about it, because it got burned up. So the longer it lasts, the less information there is. I think people enjoy speculating. They may not have the facts, but they like to think, you know, that there could have been a prince with a knife, or there could have been all kinds of stories. There could have been a foreign seaman, or there could have been somebody like Mr. Gladstone, another Victorian prime minister, who, as is well known, used to invite prostitutes to his rooms, and there he would feed them cookies and tea. And then he would take out his whip and invite them to thrash him. And then when it was all over, he would write in the margin of his diary a little whip sign, testifying to a good whipping that day. It seems to me that if you have people like that wandering the streets as prime ministers, all you need to do is to give Mr. Gladstone a little bit of medical training and teach him how to disembowel people, and he's well away as a candidate. In fact, it might be worth writing another novel simply to get Mr. Gladstone into the act. Mr. Gladstone's medical training, wherever it was, on the quiet, he studied as a doctor. And that would be real fun. I mean, somebody else will have to do that. I don't think I want to. It occurred to me after I finished writing The Women of Whitechapel that I could do it all over again with a different prime minister.
People love mysteries in more ways than one. The conspiracy theories surrounding the assassination of Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe's death. Is James Dean still alive? And is Elvis Presley performing someplace in Borneo? Now, people love that.
In fiction, they can be.
Yeah.
You know, you have carte blanche. You can do what you want. I wonder if people seeing mysteries solved and unsolved, some sort of metaphor for the way the human condition is. In other words, the unsolved mystery is really the unsolved cosmic mystery, etc., etc. Maybe it's a rehearsal for maybe the unsolved mystery is a rehearsal for never knowing the cosmic mystery. It might be a theological appetite that gets vaguely satisfied by reading mysteries, even thrillers. I'm not sure.
I love the atmosphere that you create of London and Victorian England. The picture of the flies, for example, and the strips of fly paper and so forth. But you must have done quite a bit of research in just finding out the way London was in the 19th century.
When I was an academic, one of the strings to my bow was Victorian England. So I had a lot of the right books on the shelf already and some of the right information in my head. So I didn't have to do as much research as I might otherwise have had to do. A lot of this was second nature. And I thought, well, I'm going to use this stuff and bring it back into play. And it was real fun to go back to things I hadn't thought about for, I don't know, 25 years and become a Victorian, a quasi-Victorian scholar all over again. Victorian England is a very interesting place, and there are many things buried. It was really scandalous and ghoulish. It wasn't decorous at all. When you have 500 women being butchered in one suburb annually, there's something wrong. It's almost as if there's a hunting season which lasts all the year round.
Kind of like the 43rd Precinct here in New York.
Right. Same thing. I'm not sure whether the numbers are the same. I think Whitechapel was probably more dangerous if you were a woman. But obviously these these prostitutes going out every night were really dicing with death every time they moved. And there were, I suppose, well-to-do Johnnies with knives and God knows what else coming down from the well-to-do parts of London and going down to Whitechapel to bump off a couple of women for fun, apparently. This is what was going on. And it's... what are the figures? Whitechapel, whose population was about 80,000, had about 1,200 prostitutes, whereas London overall had 80,000 prostitutes. So the population of Whitechapel was equivalent to the prostitutional population of London in total. Interesting figures. Where did all these women come from? They couldn't have come from London because there wouldn't have been enough of them to go out at the rate of 500 a year. They must have been coming from the provinces and from Scotland, as like these women and the women of Whitechapel. They must have been coming from Scotland and Ireland and, I guess, Wales to do a sort of Dick Whittington, to turn the trick of fortune. And probably many of them didn't last very long. The greenest of them got killed first, is what I would conclude. So there was always this terrible supply of women coming from the outskirts, ending up in Whitechapel, selling their bodies for 4 pence per night, or 4 pence per act anyway, and maybe not lasting more than a few months.
It struck me as
a terrifying thing.
Yeah, it is terrifying, and it's frightening when you think that London was the civilization's greatest city in the 19th century to have all of this going on.
You have all this wonderful literature being written. You know, people like Matthew Arnold and Walter Pater putting together exquisite sentences while Whitechapel is being disemboweled. I wanted to get the women into it. Most books, but I guess even most novels about this, deal with the Ripper and his frame of mind and who was he and why was he this way. I wanted to get into the frame of mind of the women, and the first attempt at this novel was almost operatic. I wanted to get the voices of the women, as it were, singing arias to one another or to the whole of London, almost simultaneously. You can't do it in a linear mode like fiction. You could do it if it were an opera, and you could have a contralto and soprano and so on, and individualize the four main women in that way. But I found that in writing in a linear narrative mode, I couldn't do it. There's no way you can without getting very, very technical and obscure. So I dropped that idea and wrote it in a much more linear fashion, still trying to get across how these women felt. I mean, especially as number one went down and whoever was number two, it was going to happen fairly soon, and it did. Between murder one and murder two, there was a week, and then between murders two and three, there were 3 weeks, and then between three and four, which were together, and five, there was, I think, 5 weeks. And the agonizing wait. I mean, these women had signed letters to Lord Salisbury and Queen Victoria, and suddenly they see one of their number go down, and she's not a typical murder. And in the middle of it all, Jack the Ripper announces that he's Jack the Ripper. So they must have had terrible yearnings to go to Australia or Liverpool, anywhere quick to get out. There's no record of any of this, and so I wanted to try and fill in how they felt. And I felt very badly losing my prostitutes in the last 200 pages.
Well, you probably got very attached to them. They were all sweet in many respects.
Well, they were feisty. Yeah. They had lots of character, and they were all, except for Marie Kelly, all sort of middle-aged, and they weren't doing terribly well at the trade of prostitution anyway. So they were really victims in many ways, and I wanted this state of mind. I also wanted the state of mind of what it was like to be potentially one of the 500. I mean, they had all these chances among the 500 of being slaughtered, and then when Jack the Ripper arrives, disguised as Queen Victoria, they have an extra chance, too. So that was a state of mind that attracted me, much less, I guess, than why the Ripper was the Ripper. The Ripper was the Ripper because he was virtually appointed to clean up the deck, but he just got carried away, as I guess some people might.
Well, The Women of Whitechapel and Jack the Ripper, it's a challenging and exciting read, Paul West. Last, to kind of wrap things up, tell me what's ahead. You're on a nationwide tour, I guess, huh?
I was. This is almost the last act of it, unless Random House invents something new. No, it began in California. It's gone through Minneapolis and Cleveland and Boston and Washington.
What's that like, exactly, a tour like that?
It's like being a character in one of your own novels, being completely dictated to by the author. You shall go from here to there, you do this, you do that, you do this. Beckett has a short text for nothing in which one of the characters answers back to the author and more or less protests and saying, you know, why are you always showing us around? Why don't you leave us alone? Why do you assume that we are yours to show around? And you get a little bit of that feeling that how Mary Kelly must have felt, Marie Kelly, as she liked to call herself, must have felt at the hands of Paul West. I mean, slightly resentful of being, certainly being executed.
Well, the process is that which William Kennedy calls giving the book its due.
Yeah.
I guess it's a necessary process of the book publication system.
Actually, it's fun. It also...
I hope you're keeping notes. That's probably a book in itself.
It's interesting. The whole novel began from a little piece of paper the size of a postcard, and I pinned it up in front of me, and that was my only plan for the whole thing. Now it's over. I have many more ideas, and it's rather tempting to write them all down and stick them on the wall and use them as a kind of frieze or a fresco. What you do find out is what your novel is like to you. You come out of that creative process into a much more dispassionate frame of mind, and you can look back, and as I was saying, if I had thought about it, I might have done much more with Mr. Gladstone, who really deserved a role, a walk-on role. Somebody wants to make a musical. This is the culmination, the culminative grace of the whole thing. They think this would make...
I have to get Stephen Sondheim on this,
yeah,
right away.
A Broadway musical. And I can see it, and I will get my long-deferred dream of having the women sing simultaneously.
That's perfect.
Why not?
No subject has ever escaped Broadway anyway.
You don't think so? No. Has there been a Jack the Ripper musical?
Well,
I don't know.
I don't think so.
There must have been something.
The time is ripe.
The time is ripe. When
this is all over, Paul, you're going to go back to Ithaca. Then what are your future plans?
I'm going to let the well fill up, and I have some good ideas, I think, now for a new novel, and I just finished another one, a very long one. Here I go again, you see. And I thought I would get out of this historical impersonation, Stauffenberg, Byron, Jack the Ripper, and go back to what looks like complete invention. I ended up writing a long novel about my parents as childhood sweethearts, way back in the early years of the century. Not much later than Jack the Ripper, actually. And I thought, well, they both told me an enormous amount about their lives. Why not use it? Then I kept finding enormous gaps, stuff they never told me. And so I invented that and invented their lives, and it was great. Reacquainting myself with them when they were 10, 12, 15, mm-hmm. or whatever. So this was quite taxing to write. I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be to fill in some of the gaps, and how presumptuous I would feel inventing their sex lives and things like that. But I, my sister and I are convinced they did have a sex life. We find it hard to believe. And so the novelist fills in the gap. I'm sure they won't object.
That's a perfect description of a novelist, the person who fills in the gap.
Yeah, I think that probably will do it. There are lots of other definitions, but, you know, such as a novel is a prose fiction of a certain length having something wrong with it. We heard that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a slicky. But filling in the gaps, psychologizing from a distance, simply guessing about people is, the art of the novel is full of guesswork. It has to be. It's not a documentary mode at all. I don't think it is.
Well, Paul Westerd, an engaging guy, The Women of Whitechapel and Jack the Ripper, terrific read. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.